You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Tuesday, March 30th, 2021. My name is Emma Vigeland, in for Sam Steeder, and this is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Ido Conrad, editor-in-chief of 972 Magazine, joins me to discuss the right-wing victories in Israel's elections last week. Meanwhile, health officials warn of a fourth COVID-19 wave as restrictions, including mask mandates in some areas, begin to melt away throughout the country. The seven-day rolling average of infections rose for the seventh straight day in a row, a 12% weekly increase. Biden is beginning his pivot to infrastructure with a speech scheduled today in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. How about that filibuster reform, though, Joe? In Georgia, civil and voting rights groups have filed a second lawsuit challenging Republicans' restrictive voting laws that were signed into law last week, as calls grow for the PGA Tour to pull out of the upcoming Masters tournament in the state. As the Biden administration extends the eviction moratorium through June 30th, a CBS analysis finds that despite their complaints, landlords have actually been largely profitable during the pandemic, with Invitation Homes, the nation's largest single-family home landlord, recording its most profitable year ever. Here in New York City, a 65-year-old Asian woman was brutally attacked and stomped on in broad daylight in Midtown as the attacker made anti-Asian statements and the doorman at the luxury building closing the doors as she was beaten in front of them. The Arkansas State Senate has passed a bill which would make gender-affirming health care for trans minors, including hormone blockers, illegal. Similar bills are being considered in dozens of other state legislatures, and the ACLU has warned that it is the most extreme threat to trans rights yet. And lastly, the National Bureau of Economic Research report has found that the wealthiest 1% of U.S. residents account for for one-third of all unpaid taxes in America. All this and more on today's program. Welcome to the show, ladies and gentlemen. As I said before, despite my glasses and the fact that I'm in his seat, I am not Sam Steeder, and I'm in for him all week. Very excited to talk to Ido Conrad about Israeli politics. I'm excited to learn even more. It's great to actually just have a conversation with an expert on the topic as opposed to really reading things in bits and pieces myself. But first, I want to talk about the leading story today, which is Derek Chauvin's trial continues in Minneapolis, I believe, in Minnesota. He is the police officer who knelt on George Floyd's neck for 9 minutes and 29 seconds, resulting in George Floyd's death. But his defense is claiming otherwise. They're resting on a few things, that there was fentanyl in George Floyd's system when he passed away, and they're claiming he resisted arrest, which is obvious that he didn't if you watched the video. And now their other claim that the defense is making, the officers, they were so distracted. Chauvin was too distracted to know that he shouldn't have dug his knee with his hands in his pockets into the neck of a man who said, "I can't breathe," 27 times before dying, and continued to kneel on his neck for at least 3 minutes after he was no longer breathing and an officer said, "I can't find a pulse." Let's listen to what his defense has to say, though.
There are people across the street. There are cars stopping, people yelling. There is a growing crowd and what officers perceive to be a threat. They're called names. Heard them this morning. A fucking bum. They're screaming at him, causing the officers to divert their attention from the care of Mr. Floyd to the threat that was growing in front of them.
The care of Mr. Floyd. curious phrasing, the care of Mr. Floyd. Now, you have to wonder, why were people stopping to watch? Do they stop just because they wanted to see someone arrest somebody else? I mean, there is rubbernecking involved in general, but they stopped because they saw a man dying in front of them. So basically, the case is currently being made by Chauvin's defense team that the officer was too distracted by the commotion that he caused by kneeling on a man's neck for over 9 minutes, because people were saying, stop it, please get off of him, please don't kill him. And then they're going to turn around and use the effects of the murder in order to excuse the murder. Now, you know, this is, I guess, what every defense attorney has to do. They have to provide the best case for their client, but it doesn't make it any less infuriating. And just an aside, I don't know that attorney's name, but a lot of what lawyers do, and Sam has talked about this a few times, they justify working on the behalf of clients in order to say everybody deserves a defense, etc. That's how a lot of corporate attorneys justify representing ExxonMobil or Goldman Sachs or whatever reprehensible company that they choose to take a fat fee from. But how do you actually stomach representing Derek Chauvin in this case? It could not be more clear that the kneeling on the neck of a man resulted in his death. The suffocating of him, the I can't breathe 27 times, those were his final words. George Floyd also cried out for his mother and said that his stomach hurt. But his final words were that he was unable to breathe. And then the officer that was helping one of the other three officers who were pushing down on George Floyd and making sure he couldn't stand up as he was being suffocated, couldn't find a pulse, Chauvin still knelt on him, still knelt on his neck, as the gurney approached a dead George Floyd. Chauvin was still kneeling on his neck.
Chauvin, again, had about a complaint a year for just under 20 years. So you wonder, were crowds involved in all of those too, making him lose his focus? Is this like the PGA Tour where you have to be completely silent as the cop does his work? I mean, yeah.
Exactly. I mean, speaking of the PGA Tour in Georgia, as they passed those horrific anti-voting bills, there's not a rule that you can't make noise when Derek Chauvin's doing his backswing, a.k.a. kneeling on a man's neck. So, look, the reason we're covering this is because these kinds of arguments have worked in the past. Many more times, than the prosecution's arguments have worked when they're going after police officers. Oftentimes because the prosecution doesn't care that much because they're all part of the same team. I'm really hoping that given the severity of what Derek Chauvin did, that this will be an exception to that rule. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, Ido Conrad of 972 Magazine will be joining us to talk about Israeli politics.
Folks, whether you're an early bird or you like to hit the snooze button, everybody deserves to sleep in ultimate comfort. And that starts with your comforter. That's why they call it a comforter. Well, Brooklinen can help you get your best sleep. I've talked about Brooklinen for years. I've gone all Brooklinen on all my sheets. What is it called? Bedware? Brooklinen creates beautiful, high-quality bedding, and home essentials. There's another word for it, too. I can't remember what it is. But they work directly with manufacturers. They give you a fair price. No middleman, no markups. Their comforters come in three different weights. Lightweight, that's mine. All season, I would contemplate. Ultra warm, I'm too hot of a sleeper. But I know there are people who like to be very warm when they sleep. So there it is. Suits every type of sleeper, every type of lifestyle. There's even a weighted comforter for option for stress relief. And those are pretty cool too, actually. They also offer a variety of materials, including eco-friendly recycled down alternative. Brooklinen's comforters pair perfectly with their sheets, pillows, and duvet covers. Look, there's a reason Brooklinen has over 75,000 five-star reviews and counting. My experience with Brooklinen has been amazing. I have gone fully Brooklinenized, as it were. And I have good-looking sheets that are super comfortable. As you know, I go for the clean, crisp version of the sheets. That's the classic, I think they call it. And then they have the more soft, maybe soft is not the right word, the more sort of like, I don't know, soft? I don't know. I like the clean, crisp that keeps me cool. But I love the sheets. I love the comforter. I love the duvet coverter. And frankly, we didn't mention it today, but I also love their towels. Treat yourself to the ultimate comfort with Brooklinen's comforter collection. Go to brooklinen.com, use the promo code MAJORITYREPORT. You get $25 off with a minimum purchase of $100. That's Brooklinen, BROOKLINEN.com. Enter the promo code MAJORITYREPORT for $25 off with a minimum purchase of $100. That's brooklinen.com, promo code MAJORITYREPORT. Also, today's program brought to you by Stamps.com. Look, you know me, I don't like to leave the house. I don't like to leave the office. I don't like to do things that aren't totally efficient. Taking trips to the post office, probably not how you want to spend your time. That's why I recommend mailing and shipping online at Stamps.com. Stamps.com allows you to mail and ship anytime, literally anytime. And you can do it anywhere right from your computer. You send letters, ship packages, pay a lot less with discounted rates from USPS, UPS, and more. Stamps.com, use your computer to print official U.S. postage 24/7. 3 a.m., no problem. 2 a.m., no problem. 11 a.m., no problem. Obviously, all the p.m.s, too. Any letter, any package, any class of mail, anywhere you want to send it. Then you just schedule a pickup or you drop it off, whatever's convenient for you. With Stamps.com, you get discounts of up to 40% off post office rates and up to 62% off UPS shipping rates. Stamps.com is a no-brainer, and it saves you time and it saves you money. Stop wasting time. Go to Stamps.com instead of the post office. There's no risk. My promo code MAJORITYREPORT. Two words, you get a special offer that includes a four-week trial plus free postage and a digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. Just go to Stamps.com, click on the microphone at the top of the homepage, and type in Majority Report. That's Stamps.com, promo code Majority Report, Stamps.com. You'll never go to the post office or leave your home again. Hey, folks. Shouldn't have to choose between a great shave and a fair price. And with Harry's, you don't have to. For a limited time, Harry's is offering their starter set plus a free travel size body wash at harrys.com/majority. Look, you've heard me say this many times before. Harry's delivers a close, comfortable shave, and they do so at a fair price, still as low as $2 per refill. How do they do it? Harry's bought a German razor blade factory that has been making blades for over 100 years. That's a century to you and I. Harry's design team combines a weighted ergonomic handle with a textured grip. It's beautiful, actually. Very classic. It's got a flex hinge. It's smart. And it's simple. It's got a razor that is designed for delivering a close shave along all the contours of your face. You don't need one of those like buffed up things that look like you're out some type of tactical maneuver. They stand behind the quality of their blades so much, they have 100% money-back guarantee on harrys.com. It gives you a great close shave. It's got that narrower shave head so that if you've got a nostril issue like myself, it takes care of it. Shaves just as well as one of those, razors you go to the drugstore for and then, you know, have to carry out that huge plastic case. But it's also just much more reasonable, less expensive, and they mail it to you. For a limited time, Harry's has their exclusive offer for an even better for listeners of this show. New customers can get a special offer in a Harry starter set and a body wash at harrys.com/majority. It's a limited time. It's the best offer you're going to find. You'll get a 5-blade razor, weighted Truman handle, foaming shave gel, a travel blade cover, and a travel size body wash. There has never been a better time to try Harry's. Try it now. Go to harrys.com/majority to redeem your free offer today.
Thanks, Sam. I would like to welcome to the program. Are you there, Ido? There you are. I would like to welcome to the program Ido Conrad, editor-in-chief of 972 Magazine. How are you today?
I'm great. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you for being here. So I just want to start with what happened in last week's elections in Israel. Let's really just start very broadly, and then we can narrow it down, a 30,000-foot view, if you will. So this was the first election, or fourth election, I should say, in 2 years in Israel. And there seems to be permanent gridlock. It appears Netanyahu won't be able to form a governing majority. Can you take us through both last week's elections and what led us to this point over the past few years under Netanyahu?
Sure. So I'll start just with your second question. Basically, the Israeli political system has been trying to get a large part of the Israeli political system has been trying to get rid of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu for the last few years, unsuccessfully. He has been accused and is sitting trial for corruption scandals, multiple corruption scandals. And a large part of the political system just finds that unacceptable today. And so over the past three, four elections have actually been about yes, Netanyahu or no Netanyahu. And the political system has been divided effectively into two blocks, the parties that support Netanyahu and the politicians that support Netanyahu and the politicians that oppose Netanyahu. And really over the last four elections, we've been seeing the anti-Bibi bloc trying to get rid of him unsuccessfully. But at the same time, Netanyahu has not been able to gain the seats necessary in the Knesset, in Israel's parliament, to actually form a ruling coalition, with the exception of the last elections that happened last March, in which Netanyahu basically cajoled his rival Benny Gantz into joining him under the pretext of fighting COVID-19 together in a so-called unity government, and so that actually effectively collapsed over the last few months, sending us back into elections. And the fourth election, as you mentioned, the fourth election in 2 years took place last week, in which yet again, neither the pro-Netanyahu coalition nor the anti-Netanyahu coalition was able to get the numbers necessary to form a coalition outright. And so now we kind of are going into a situation in which both sides are jockeying for votes, trying to get the parties and different politicians on their side in order to form the necessary, to get the necessary 61 Knesset seats. And so what we actually saw happen last week was, apart from the gridlock, which you mentioned, was three kind of big things that happened. Number one, the Palestinian citizens of Israel, their vote was split between two parties. The joint list, which is an alliance of the major streams of political thought in Israel, and the Islamist party, Ra'am, which split off from the joint list earlier this year. And so we saw that the vote actually being split between those two parties. And actually, the most interesting part of that is that a lot of Palestinian citizens, because of that split, stayed home on election day. So the Palestinian political power actually decreased in the last election. The other thing that we saw when it comes to voting patterns was that Netanyahu's kind of historic voting bloc, his base, a lot of them did stay home as well in the more kind of peripheral Mizrahi voting blocks in what's called the development towns around Israel. A lot of them actually stayed home and didn't vote for him.
Yeah, no, that's fascinating because from my understanding, Netanyahu has had a base that turns out for him every time. And so that has made the opposition effort so difficult. And I just want to rewind to Benny Gantz and the Blue and White Party. Sure. Because from an outsider's perspective, when you're making your coalition about anti-Netanyahu versus pro-Netanyahu, right, there's so much ideological fluidity. And it was difficult to see what Gantz even stood for, and that kind of came full circle when he immediately turned on the people that he supported him and caved to Netanyahu. So can you explore that moment and how that kind of led to, in what I've read, what seems like a lot of political disillusionment on behalf of voters who threw all their energy behind this anti-Netanyahu effort that ended up just kind of blowing up?
Yeah, so Gantz's big kind of pitch to the Israeli public was that he would never sit with Netanyahu for successive, you know, election cycles. This is what he sold the Israeli public, and it worked. Gantz is the former IDF chief of staff. He's an Ashkenazi man from the military brass. He is kind of the archetype of the center-left politician in Israel. And really what he sold Israelis was a return to what we call in Hebrew mamlachtiut, which is like maybe another way of saying stateliness, a return to the kind of Israel of yore, the good Israel.
Sounds familiar.
Exactly. So I mean, you know, it's not exactly make Israel great again, because if anything, Gantz wants to take us away from the more Trumpian kind of way of doing politics.
More Biden-esque in terms of return to...
Yeah, sure. Okay. So yeah, a return to like a Biden-esque normalcy. So, you know, that just didn't work when he had the chance to form the coalition. He was actually tapped by the president last March to form the ruling coalition. And he had the opportunity to make a kind of, I mean, I'd call it a historic decision to form a coalition with the backing of the Joint List. And the Joint List also, you know, compromised on their ideals in a lot of ways by saying, okay, we're going to back this former IDF chief of staff who launched his first election campaign back in 2019 by bragging about how many Palestinians he had killed as chief of staff in Gaza. And so, you know, they made this big ideological compromise in order to defeat Netanyahu, because they really, I think, believed that Gantz was serious about the one election promise that he was making to Israelis. And at the end of the day, it just seemed, you know, probably too politically costly for Gantz. Maybe he thought his coalition would fall apart. And I think part of him also trusted Netanyahu. Netanyahu was like, okay, you can come into this government. We'll have a rotation government. I'll be prime minister for 18 months. Then you take over and we'll fight COVID together and we'll beat this thing. Right. And so in retrospect, it sounds absurd. And at the time, I think to many people, it was absurd. What's really interesting also that we've seen in the results is that Gantz, you know, we expected Gantz to crash. A lot of us thought, like, who is going to vote for this guy after he really betrayed the Israeli public? And he actually managed to eke out 7 Knesset seats, which is not a bad showing at all, considering that his party completely broke up. The blue and white party split up after he effectively ditched them and went with Netanyahu. So that was a really, really big surprise for a lot of us that he managed to get those votes.
How is he center-left? Based on Israel's political spectrum, I mean, the fact that he, from my reading of things, was during his jostling with Netanyahu, basically a bake-off, who could be more anti-Palestinian and more xenophobic towards Palestinians and Israeli-Palestinians as well. So how is that considered center-left in Israel?
That's a good question. You know, I think Gantz, through the different election cycles that he's trying to defeat Netanyahu, has taken different stances. He's taken more conciliatory stances toward Palestinian citizens. When annexation was on the table and Trump's deal of the century was on the table, he took a much more right-wing approach, probably at the behest of his political advisors, who told him, this is where the political current is. You need to lean in hard to the right in order to gain maybe some Likud voters who are disillusioned with Netanyahu and his corruption trial. So lean hard into the right. On the other hand, you saw Netanyahu run 3 campaigns very, very, very strongly and stridently against Palestinian citizens. And in this last election, You saw him actually kind of portray himself, at least at the outset, as a great uniter, the great uniter of Israeli society. The fact that the Islamists broke off from the joint list was a huge political boon to Netanyahu. At least that's how he saw it. And he really tried to leverage that. His COVID-19 campaign, his vaccination campaign, was heavily, heavily based in Palestinian villages and towns and cities across Israel. And so all of a sudden, you had someone who has incited repeatedly against Palestinian leaders and citizens take a much more conciliatory tone. So I think this, it kind of, on the one hand, it's a very cynical way of understanding Israeli politics. What is center-left? What is the left? What is the right? And I'm not sure, you know, anyone has a really good answer. And on the other hand, I think it kind of goes to show that Palestinian citizens, for many in the Zionist consensus, you know, the Zionist consensus in Israeli politics, are a tool to win elections, are a tool to make sure that, you know, a vaccination campaign will be successful. But Palestinian citizens have their own desires, have their own political agenda. It's a very, you know, a varied political agenda. They don't agree on necessarily all the terms, but it goes beyond whether someone like Benny Gantz is going to lead the country or whether Netanyahu is going to lead the country. Or in this case, you know, in this election, we saw Yair Lapid is kind of the big victor after these elections for the so-called center-left.
So let's then bring it to the joint list, which you keep referencing, right? And the break off of Mansour Abbas, who is a Palestinian-Israeli politician who seems to be signaling that he's siding with Netanyahu. And my understanding is that the joint list was a lot more centrist than what Abbas is trying to put forward as a Palestinian-Israeli politician. More right-wing, more anti-LGBTQ seems to be something he's hanging his hat on in order to buddy up with Netanyahu, who's in power, who seems to be using him as a prop in many ways in order to appear less extreme than Netanyahu is. So can you talk about that dynamic, why the faction in the joint list broke happened, and how Abbas is positioning himself in regards to Netanyahu?
So I think one of the kind of basic things we need to understand about the joint list is that it was formed and forged out of necessity when Avigdor Lieberman, a far-right Israeli politician, who's considered a centrist, to your previous question, he's considered kind of a center-right, but he is a hawk and a nationalist. He actually put forth a law to bring up the election threshold to make it harder for smaller parties, which were typically the Arab parties in the Israeli parliament, to make it into the Knesset. So this actually forced the four major political factions in Palestinian society, the communists, the nationalists, the Islamists, and I'd say Ahmed Tibi, who has this kind of politician that is unclear exactly where to place him on the spectrum, but forced all of them into this party that I think the right did not really correctly estimate how powerful they could be when together. What happened, I think, that really started the breakup of the list, and I don't attribute this to any necessarily wrongdoing or malice, was Ayman Odeh, the chairman of the list, voted to support Benny Gantz. And the list actually voted to support Benny Gantz in the previous elections before Benny Gantz turned his back on them and went into the government with Netanyahu. This was kind of seen as a pivotal moment. And so what Mansour Abbas does this time around, he says, well, okay, Ayman Odeh did this last time. You know, he said, okay, we're ready to make this historic compromise with someone who brags about...
I'm sorry to interrupt, but I should just quickly say they were very successful in teaming up with Benny Gantz. And it showed, wow, they won 15 seats. Is that correct?
Yeah, I mean, I think it depends who you ask. I think, you know, historically, if you're looking at Israeli politics, it's considered like a very big success, and it shows just how kind of it shows that you can't actually make any big political moves in Israeli society today without Palestinian citizens. And so Mansour Abbas internalized that. He understood that, and he knew that. Now, one thing we need to understand about Mansour Abbas is that, you know, he is an Islamist, but he comes from the more moderate kind of segment of Islamist politics. In previous election cycles, he's spoken, you know, he hasn't spoken outright against the LGBTQ community, said he needs to study the issue. And although he holds he held conservative positions, you know, a man is a man, a woman is a woman, kind of things that we hear typically from conservative circles that won't sound foreign to many Americans and many people in the West. He wasn't using his bully pulpit to come down hard on the LGBTQ community. Now, in this election cycle, he's really neat as he broke off from the joint list and he saw the opportunity that Netanyahu could potentially give him, and inspired, I'd say, by the fact that, you know, that Ayman Odeh previously said, yeah, we're gonna take these chances. We're gonna kind of break from precedent. And he used that, and he used his conservative politics to basically bolster his political standing. And he really, really tried to burnish those conservative Islamist credentials. And this time really coming out against the LGBTQ community and trying to differentiate himself from the rest of the joint list, which you said that they've taken more centrist positions. They actually, you know, have taken many progressive positions as well. And it's hard to really place them because they're this hodgepodge of different ideologies. But at this, you know, while many of them do hold more, I'd say, reactionary positions, some of them also hold very, very progressive and left-wing positions on LGBTQ rights, certainly on Palestinian rights, certainly on the occupation, workers' rights, et cetera, et cetera. So what Abbas is basically doing is saying, I am no longer part of this alliance, and I am going to show you exactly what political Islam stands for, and I'm going to make, this is going to be a new kind of chapter in Palestinian Jewish relations in Israeli society. And at the same time, I'm going to be a kingmaker. I'm going to be the one who gets to decide whether I go with Netanyahu or whether I go with Yair Lapid or whoever leads the anti-Bibi bloc now.
Yeah, I mean, that's fascinating. But like, outside of his own careerism, what does that substantively mean for Palestinian citizens? Because, you know, he can posture in terms of religious fundamentalism or religious, you know, anti-LGBTQ positions. But what does that mean for the occupation based on how he's going to cozy up to Netanyahu? Like, that is so unclear to me. And that would seem to be the number one issue if you were representing Palestinian Israelis.
So I think what Abbas has done, and this is, you know, this is to his kind of credit, is say there are certain issues, there are certain red lines that I will not cross, that in order to be in any coalition government, I will demand an end to home demolitions of Palestinian homes inside Israel. I will demand the repeal of the Jewish nation state law, a law that passed in 2018 that constitutionally enshrines the second class status of Palestinian citizens and non-Jews in Israel effectively. And so there are certain things that, you know, are kind of widely accepted in Palestinian society as, you know, priorities, political priorities for any political leader to try and push through. What Abbas isn't doing is actually putting issues like the occupation and the national rights of Palestinian citizens of Israel as top priorities. And this kind of differentiates him from the joint list and the various factions in the joint list. And you know, to his credit, whether we like it or not, there are strong currents in Arab society in Israel and Palestinian society in Israel that are saying, yeah, we just want basic civil rights. Don't demolish our homes. Treat us like you would treat any other citizen. The national stuff we can put to the side. The being recognized as a national minority, re-recognizing Arabic as a national language. These kinds of things seem to be less pertinent to Mansour Abbas today. That doesn't mean that there isn't kind of a clash over these ideologies inside Palestinian society. And this is something that we're going to see play out, I think, over the next few years. If there's another election, it'll be really, really interesting to see how that'll play out in the next election.
How much of that has to do with just Palestinians feeling beaten down by this political process and feeling like there's no voice and like, oh, we're going to accept basically crumbs from the one guy that can get close to Netanyahu? I mean, that's what it sounds like to me.
So, I mean, we need a kind of, we need one thing we need to know about the Islamist politics in Israel is that most people don't know that much about it. I mean, people inside and commentators and experts definitely know a lot about Islamist politics in Israel, but to the lay person, you know, a lot of people really didn't expect him to get the necessary 4 seats to, you know, to pass the election threshold and to enter Knesset. And a lot of people were extremely surprised, myself included, by the numbers that the Islamist party was able to garner in these elections. These are, you know, they have people, activists across the country riling up support for Abbas. So that's kind of a basic thing that we need to remember about this party. They have a lot of popular support relative to at least to what a lot of people expected. I think to answer your question, kind of looking at it from the side, not as a Palestinian, but looking at it from the side, I think the joint list, when it ran together with the Islamists last time around, won 15 seats. That's a record high for the joint list since it was formed in 2015 out of those kind of political circumstances of necessity. And so it's hard for me to say. I think that, you know, what we can say is that when they run together, all four parties run together, there is a lot more excitement in the in Palestinian communities. Still, you know, despite the tensions inside the parties between the varying ideologies, and not just between the Islamists and the rest of them, but, you know, between the communists and the nationalists and the liberals, it's a difficult kind of ship to steer. That when they work together and put aside those differences and say, okay, we can agree on a set of political principles that we want to put forward, they do get a lot more support from Palestinians, and Palestinians feel actually, I think, empowered by that. And they do go out and vote in relatively high numbers. So it's not so much that, you know, the best that they can hope for is crumbs from Mansour Abbas. I think maybe a different way of framing it is that when they work together and they do talk about issues like the occupation, as well as issues that directly affect Palestinian citizens of Israel, their power is almost unrivaled by any other political force in Israel. And that's really, to their credit, is what's made them so formidable for the kind of the Jewish Zionist consensus in Israel, and what has made Palestinian politics essential to both understand and to take into account when thinking about what's politically possible in Israel.
Right. And so then let's bring it back to, I guess, extremism from the Zionist side, really, and why this is also just especially a dangerous situation in how Netanyahu is appealing to Jewish extremism and far right forces within Israel in order to gain power in parliament. Now, they actually won this time around. This far right party that was, I think associated with past terroristic acts, Itamar Ben-Gvir, I hope I pronounced it semi-okay. Can you talk about him as a leader of the far-right movement there, how Netanyahu cozied up to him in order to try to build his coalition, which seems he may have failed still, what that means for Israeli politics, who he is, and what the roots in Jewish extremism mean for politics as a whole?
Sure. So I think I'll start by talking about Netanyahu, that for Netanyahu, the name of the game is political survival. He's facing these corruption trials that really can not only put an end to his political career, but land him in prison for quite a long time. And so this is his number one priority, political survival. And in order to do that, he needs to form a coalition that will pass a law that will prevent a sitting prime minister from actually facing trial and going to prison over anything, basically. So this is in his interest to stay in power. And you know, Netanyahu, for all of the terrible things that we can say about him, he is kind of leagues above all of the rest of Israel's politicians, because he understands, I think, he has the most to lose in this situation, and really will do what just seemed impossible in the past. And seemed outrageous in the past in order to stay in power. And it might work for him. We're yet to see whether it will work for him, but it might work for him.
I don't know if that can be spun as a positive, but I hear your point.
Yeah, I don't think it's a positive thing, but it is. It is kind of, you know, he plays politics. Like he really plays politics, and it's a no holds barred game for him. And so, in order to do this, he knew this isn't the first time that he's done this. He needs to bring in extremists into his already far right block that he depends on, and so he has tapped Itamar Ben-Gvir, the head of Otzma Yehudit, a Jew, name for the Jewish Power Party in Israel, whose roots lie in an ideology called Kahanism, based on the ideology of Rabbi Meir Kahana, an American Jew who started the Jewish Defense League in the United States, which was designated a terrorist organization by the United States. He moved to Israel and formed a political party that was banned in the Knesset and then also designated a terrorist organization. And so Itamar Ben-Gvir, like his ideological predecessor, believes in a Palestinian free Israel, transferring Palestinians, kicking them out of the country, installing some kind of theocratic government, instead of what we might call a liberal democracy, though I'm not sure that term applies to Israel so much, but instead of democratic institutions, religious institutions that would rule the country, and really just the face of what we would call Jewish extremism in Israel today. He distances himself from Kahana, though he does call him a great man, I think, in order to kind of put on a friendly face to the Israeli media, which really, you know, he's this kind of like, almost this like teddy bear extremist. He's like very charming. He's invited to newsrooms. And this is the same guy that, you know, in the 90s pulled the sign off of Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin's car and said, you know, we got to Rabin's car. Soon enough, we'll get to the prime minister himself too. The prime minister was eventually assassinated by a right-wing extreme Jewish extremist.
Yes. Which leads to the very ideology that was for part of his formation into a political person. So, I mean, it's
right.
Deeply like dark and prescient.
Right. And so I agree with all those things. And, so Ben-Gvir essentially joined up with another extremist called Bezalel Smotrich, who represents kind of another edge of the far right of the religious Zionist movement in Israel, and the Noam Party, which just has run a blatantly homophobic campaign. Their entire existence is predicated on kind of restoring the normative Jewish family, very, very homophobic. And so those three parties, those three slates ran together as one, and Netanyahu effectively tapped them to be part of his coalition. He encouraged the unity between Ben-Gvir and Smotrich in order for them to pass the election threshold and get as many seats as possible so that they could be in his coalition, so that Netanyahu could get 61 seats, so that Netanyahu could pass the law to protect him from going to prison. So all of this political calculus, that this short-sighted political calculus of one man, Benjamin Netanyahu, the prime minister, brings in these dark forces back into the Knesset, where they haven't been for a long time. I think one thing that's important to know about Kahanism, and a writer for 972 magazine, Natasha Roth Roland, said this on one of our podcast episodes, is that Kahanism doesn't actually necessarily need a political party to thrive. Because its roots lay in this kind of ambiguous tension between the Jewish and democratic tension in the state of Israel. The Kahanists don't believe in the democratic part of the state of Israel. They only believe in the Jewish part of Israel. But since Israel's founding in 1948, hundreds and hundreds of laws have been passed to back essentially the Jewish part of the state of Israel. Whether it's been the law of return, land confiscations of Palestinian refugees, expropriation of more land, the Jewish nation state law, the entire existence of the state of Israel is there to bolster Jewish presence and a Jewish demographic majority and Jewish power over non-Jews in the country. With these kind of liberal democratic institutions that exist almost alongside of it, but But Kahanism kind of understands, kind of what Kahana did was he understood that at the heart of the matter is you don't need a Kahana in the Knesset. You don't effectively need an Itamar Ben-Gvir in the Knesset in order for these things to, in order for the spirit of Kahana to float above the parliament and to be part of the kind of daily politics of this place.
But and I know we'll let you go shortly, but lastly, but now there is. Now that ideology is in the Knesset, and that was an explicit decision or strategy by Netanyahu in order to protect himself really from this corruption trial, and to tie it back to Abbas. Abbas has also signaled that he might support legislation or a law that would protect Netanyahu from this corruption trial. So let's bring it back. How much of this is really... Well, you kind of already answered it, but this is so much about Netanyahu's trial and protecting himself. Really, the question is, what are the long-term ramifications based on that short-term decision to protect one guy?
It's a good question. One of the basic kind of things that I think people should know is that Israelis are right-wing. The majority of Israelis support right-wing ideas. They vote for right-wing parties. If it weren't for Netanyahu, the right wing in Israel would be able to form a coalition. And Netanyahu has basically, you know, so many people have gotten so sick of him that they've defected from his party. You have Gideon Saar, who is a Likudnik, who formed his own party, who otherwise would have been in Likud. And you have people like Naftali Bennett, who is also a religious Zionist, but kind of a stately version of the religious Zionist stream, who's unsure about whether or not he'll recommend Netanyahu, or he'll recommend Lapid, or he'll take us to another election. And so without Netanyahu kind of holding politics hostage, we would already have a right-wing majority in the Knesset. The left and the center-left in Israel and the Palestinian parties are still a minority in Israeli society and in voting patterns, and they would be a minority in any Knesset that we would see. The long-term ramifications of Netanyahu bringing in the Kahanists is, if they are able to form a coalition, is more, I'd say, you know, even harsher laws being passed against Palestinian citizens, more warmongering, many more conservative bills being put to the plenum. And I think a really, really bad situation. Like I would not be looking forward to a situation in which not only would Ben-Gvir be in the coalition, but he would also be holding onto a ministerial portfolio. So really averting that in the short term is a good thing. But if you want to look at the long game, it's not Ben-Gvir who we should be talking about. It's kind of this idea that Israelis are already so right-wing. They already support right-wing policies and right-wing parties. And I think that without kind of an alternative to that, that offers Israelis a different way, and in many ways, I think the joint list is the kind of beginning of that, offers Israelis a different way forward, a way forward based on equality and rights for all, and social solidarity. Without that, the lurch to the right will continue and continue and continue.
Okay, I lied. Last question. So how do you build leftist power? You've written about the need to do so. You talk about the joint list there. There's also the remnants of the Labour Party.
Right.
I mean, the fall from grace for the Labour Party is, you know, you can talk about that and touch on that in your answer, but what do you think is the path forward for building leftist power, as Netanyahu has had a stranglehold over that country and right-wing ideology, as you mentioned, just has become so entrenched?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I wish I had one kind of decisive answer that would, you know, people would listen to and be convinced of. I think it starts with kind of putting front and center the most marginalized communities and letting them lead. And that begins with Palestinian citizens of Israel. And it means that, you know, the more leftist, left-ish, dovish Zionist parties like Meretz and Labor, first of all, show solidarity with Palestinian citizens of Israel. I know Meretz does that to a certain degree. But I think it won't start from the Knesset. It won't start from parliament that's already, you know, as I mentioned before, like so skewed to the right. Israeli society is already such a society that's geared toward maintaining Jewish, you know, I don't like the term Jewish power, but Jewish supremacy over Israel, Palestine, the entirety of Israel, Palestine, that I think these things will start from outside the Knesset, and they'll start from grassroots organizing on the left, organizations that believe first and foremost in equality and solidarity with all kind of oppressed groups in Israel, Palestine, starting with Palestinians, but certainly not limited to Palestinian citizens, extended to Ethiopian citizens and extended to Mizrahi communities and the LGBTQ communities. And I think building a foundation that's based not on how do we kind of continue and entrench Jewish supremacy, but how do we break that down? And how do we break down those walls of fear toward fear and animosity toward Palestinian citizens of Israel and say, okay, you're not only an essential part of the society that we want to build here, you are the leaders of the fight toward that kind of vision.
Thank you so much. Ido Conrad, 972 Magazine, where can people find some more of your work? Right there?
Yeah, www.972mag.com. And follow us on Twitter, on Instagram. Listen to our monthly podcast. We're everywhere.
Appreciate you taking the time to talk to me today. Thanks so much.
No problem. Thanks so much.
We are going to take a quick break, and we will be right back. Right. So we'll end on this and then head into the fun half. Pete Buttigieg, back on the scene. Over the weekend, I believe it was on Friday, he went out on a limb and went a bit rogue and decided he was going to speak for the Biden administration on a proposal surrounding climate change and transportation. Now, we'll see how that turned out for him. Let's first take a listen to what he said on Friday.
Just give me 1 second here.
Sure. No problem. Again, guys, it's just me and Matt this week. Brendan and Sam are out, so Matt's doing two jobs.
The link went to a Chris Wallace clip, so which was not what I was looking for from yesterday. Sorry. And now I can't find. Oh, here it is. Okay. So if you want to set that up, give me just a little bit.
Sure, no problem. So Pete Buttigieg, he on Friday made a bold proclamation about a potential transportation policy related to climate change that seemed to be not connected to anything the Biden administration, you know, Biden's his boss. I'm not sure if Pete's aware of that, was proposing. And to me, it sounded like something Fox News would make up in order to make the left wing seem elitist and characterize climate change proposals as burdensome on the regular person. But Pete ran with it anyway. So this is what he said on Friday, and then we'll see how quickly he had to walk it back.
Long-term answer. What about a mileage-based tax?
So I think that shows a lot of promise. If we believe in that so-called user pays principle, the idea that part of how we pay for roads is you pay based on how much you drive, the gas tax used to be the obvious way to do it. It's not anymore. So a so-called vehicle miles traveled tax or mileage tax, whatever you want to call it, could be a way to do it. Long-term answer.
So a mileage tax. All right. That is a regressive idea. Now, I know that states like Oregon have floated a mileage tax, but that is in order to get electric vehicles to basically pay what the gas tax does. In order for the ability to drive, you should be paying some sort of tax. But again, why is that falling on the people who are driving, especially the people who are driving electric cars, which is something we're supposed to be incentivizing? We already have toll roads as well. So this was such a bad kind of him talking out of his ass moment that on Saturday, the New York Times reported that an official from the Department of Transportation had to walk it back. And then Buttigieg had to go on TV with Jake Tapper and walk it back publicly again.
Said also that a mileage tax showed, quote, a lot of promise as a way to help pay for the plan. That tax would charge people for how many miles they drive. Is that under consideration?
No, that's not part of the conversation about this infrastructure bill. So just want to make sure that's really clear. But you will be hearing a lot more details in the coming days about how we envision being able to fund this. And again, these are carefully thought through, responsible ideas that ultimately are going to be a win for the economy and need to be compared to the unaffordable cost of the status quo.
Okay, so something about...
Wait, don't play that, play that.
Oh, okay, 1 second.
Just goes something of a backtrack. That was the most satisfying part.
We are going to be a win for the economy and need to be compared to the unaffordable cost of the status quo.
Okay, so something of a backtrack on that. Let me say that also.
Another thing that, Pete, I thought you were down home and you were from Indiana, and that made you a really relatable presidential candidate, even though you talk like you were built in the lab to be a politician. Rural areas would also be hit hardest with this. And this is another reason it was tailor-made for conservative fear-mongering about climate change policy. More miles are driven in rural areas. And so a mileage tax would be a bad way to implement it in terms of just the geographical diversity of this country. Fox News was jumping all over this all over the weekend. As soon as Buttigieg said it, they had commentary about it. And so he had to walk it back immediately. Do find it a bit satisfying. Obviously, if I were to have to pick between Biden and Buttigieg for president, based on what Biden's done thus far, I probably would pick Biden. But back then, I don't even know what that was. That would be. That was a real Sophie's choice there, not a good one. But it is amusing to me and strangely gratifying for Buttigieg to be told, no, you're not making these decisions on your own.
Boss,
you don't get to live out your kind of bureaucratic fantasy where you're the kingmaker in this situation. This is a legislative issue, and go back to being transportation secretary, dude.
Yeah, I mean, it's telling that it didn't come up in his initial response at all that, oh, this might be insanely regressive, particularly to rural poor people. I will say I am of two minds about this as a North Dakotan, but also someone who hates cars. I think the way that you do this is you tax the rich people and build enough public transportation and alternatives to the automobile, which I think has been horrible. And I think there's a certain desire for an electric car to sort of maintain this personal automobile hell that I would describe modern cities to have become. Just freeways through neighborhoods that obviously have a lot of like racial implications and stuff like that. I think the car has been a disaster and I don't like it. But yeah, you can't do it in a regressive way. You just can't do it, particularly if you're a Democratic Party that wants to start like, shaving the margins you're getting killed by in rural areas. Just completely insane. And he should know better, coming from Indiana, but of course that's not really where he comes from. He comes from the neoliberal petri dish.
Exactly. So I mean, there's the substantive point that Matt's talking about, but the political point is even bigger, just based on the fact that there are already many regressive tacks that are in place in order to but actually that isn't the point. In this infrastructure bill, it should be very much a tax on the companies and the corporations that are continuing to pump fossil fuels into our country, and that's what should fund that public infrastructure and wealthy Americans as well. You don't make it a flat, which eventually becomes regressive, mileage tax that would then target rural poor people in a very difficult and specific disproportionate way. But really just How would you think when you're talking to the media and you're that calculated of a guy that that would be a good political winning point, especially when it seems like it wasn't agreed upon by the administration? Although maybe it was discussed. And then as soon as they saw the backlash, they walked it back. But to me, this smells of Buttigieg, you know, thinking he's a little bit bigger for his britches than he actually is.
Yeah, I mean, the Gilets Jaunes protests in France were caused by a fuel tax that Macron eventually had to scrap. I think you don't want to be too draw too direct of an analogy, because France will go to the barricades over a lot. And I mean, not that America hasn't, you know, protested recently, but, you know,
richer history in terms
you are,
of
you're playing with fire.
Yeah, right. Yes, you're playing with fire.
Or the fuel for fire.
Yeah, you're pouring gasoline on a fire. There we go. Gas tax. All right, we are going to head into the fun hat. But first, Matt, what is happening on Left Reckoning?
Oh, yeah, folks, go subscribe. Got a nice little bump to subscribers from a YouTube chat. Again, people, you can give you permission to navigate away from this during our transition to the fun half, and go subscribe to Left Reckoning, where on Thursday night we had Shama Sawan to talk about the BS recall effort against her and how to build socialist power at a local level, and also Wozni Lambre to talk about the threatened 1964 All-Star Game threat by Elgin Baylor, Jerry West, and Oscar Robertson that won the NBA Players Association for that was not being recognized by the owners, but prior to that, the Red Auerbach, like that, those type of villains. So we talk about that. Go check that out at patreon.com/leftreckoning. But more importantly, go subscribe today. That's the call to action. Go subscribe to the YouTube channel, folks.
Yes, please subscribe. We want to bump up Matt's subscribers. And
oh, and let's bring in Nomi so she can.
Yes, so she can plug.
She can plug. Yeah, and this week we're doing a show on legalization of marijuana around the country with Brian Brown. So I'm looking forward to that as well. Hey, Nomiki.
Hello. Hi, guys.
Plug Matt a little bit more. It was very interesting to me because I'm like, wow, I'm getting confused about all these different state laws and how which ones are substantively better than the other. They're going to break that down on Left Reckoning, which, you know, marijuana laws are actually quite restrictive and which aren't as legalization ramps up throughout the country. Nomi, what's happening on your show?
What's up, Emma? Hi. Looking good. The lighting is exceptionally lovely on that side, I have to say.
I think so. I kind of miss my lighting over there. I think it's darker, so it makes me look more tan, but, you know, make me look tan.
You look very like even. It's I'm a big fan of good lighting, which I don't know how to do in my place, because that's like an expertise in its own. Anyways, today is a big day because it is the Amazon vote, and we have Chris Smalls on, who of course was the Amazon worker who went to war with Amazon during COVID over COVID, how they were dealing with COVID in Staten Island at the facility there. He's based in New Jersey. He's been organizing relentlessly. He's been on the show many times. You guys are probably aware of him. So he's going to be on as our main guest. And then later we have Joshua Kahn Russell and Napoleon DeLegend on to discuss all the newsiness of the day.
Beautiful. Wonderful. All right, let's head into the fun half. And we got some clips, we got some calls, we got some IMs, we got some bing, we got some boom. Let's go.
Bada bing, bada boom.
Left is best. Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous, you're a little bit upset, you're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude. You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Some good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Oh, hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457.
32, 38, 56, 27. One half, 5/8, 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd.
Don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance.
Ooh. Grandpa.
I had my first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jab.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good.
Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
I think I might be a Nazi.
Agree.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up.
Ooh.
Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. Let's I wanna just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me.
Hey, shut up!
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.